Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Annabella Breck, and today we'll be talking to Megan Kate Nelson about her new book, The Three-Cornered War: The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. Megan Nelson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Megan, I wonder if you could kick things off today by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure, of course. I was born in Colorado and lived most of my early life there until I went off to college. Did my undergraduate degree in history and literature at Harvard University, and then taught for a little while, taught English classes on the secondary level, and then went off to grad school at the University of Iowa in American studies. So all of my training has been interdisciplinary, which I think has shaped a lot of my work, in that I am very happy and open to using a wide variety of sources in all of the work that I do, particularly as I started to focus in my dissertation work more on environmental studies. I started to look at all kinds of different ways that we can access landscape histories, including personal on the ground experience and scientific data, meteorology, things of that sort. So I started my career as I was saying, as an environmental historian of the Southeast, and my dissertation was a cultural history of the Okefenokee Swamp in southern Georgia and northern Florida. And from there, as I was mucking around in the swamp, I noticed a lot of ruins in their midst, and so became really interested in destruction as a process and as an idea and a lived experience. And that propelled me into my second book, Ruin Nation, which is about the Civil War and four different kinds of destruction involved in that conflict, which was the destruction of cities and houses and forests and bodies. And I think if you talk to most people who do Civil War history, once you start doing it, it's very hard to stop. I continued my Civil War work into my third book, which is the book that we're going to discuss today, The Three-Cornered War. But instead of focusing on the Southeast, I have come back home in a way to the West and the Southwest to really figure out what the Civil War was like in that theater. Because growing up in Colorado, I had actually never heard that there was any kind of Civil War history that involved Colorado soldiers, that involved indigenous peoples living in the West or anywhere west of the Mississippi, really. And so I became really interested not only in what had gone on in the West during the 1860s, but also why both Westerners and most Americans really have never heard about this theater of the war or really have considered it as part of Civil War history.
Great. Thank you for that. And how did you come to write The Three-Cornered War?
So this was part of my process. As I was saying, I kind of was embroiled in Civil War history, not only writing Ruined Nation, but also teaching a lot of courses to undergrads and graduate students in Civil War history. And when I found out that there were these couple of battles, Valverde, Apache Canyon, and Glorieta Pass, between Union and Confederate soldiers, I was shocked to hear about that, shocked to know that there were Colorado soldiers involved in that. And then as I started to research it, I became really aware that this was much larger than just a handful of battles between Union and Confederate soldiers. This was, in fact, as the title of the book suggests, a three-cornered war between the Union, the Confederacy, and Native peoples. And that particularly Apaches and Navajos were very deeply involved in fighting for control over the West. And so this is what kind of led me to the larger topic and trying to convey the fullest possible history of the Civil War in this region, which really took place between 1861, the summer of 1861, and the summer of 1868, which is a much longer trajectory than most Civil War historians and a lot of military historians will accept. But part of this recent move toward considering other theaters of the war and toward looking at multiple kinds of participants in the war is, in fact, a broadening out not only of geography, but also of chronology. So we don't necessarily abide by the traditional Civil War chronology of the firing on Fort Sumter in April of 1861 to Appomattox in April of 65. So the timeline in the Three-Cornered War is longer and has different kind of pinpoints where the war in the West really turns and, you know, sort of important moments that shape its trajectory.
The history of the American Civil War in the Continental West, as you show in the book and as you just explained to us so well now, is very vast in scope. Yet driving your book about this vast historical landscape are the experiences of nine individuals. Why take this approach?
So I figured out two things early on in the research process. One was that there were many different stories to tell about the Civil West. It had a lot of moving parts. There were a lot of communities involved. They were moving all over the West at different points. They were coming together in different places and times. And I knew that was going to be complicated to tell this story and to really tell it fully from all of these different perspectives. I also knew that I wanted to really write this book differently than my previous two books. Trembling Earth and Ruined Nation are pretty traditional academic books, you know, with an introduction and four or five thematic chapters and then a conclusion. And they're really quite argument driven because that is the academic style. That was how I'd been trained and how I'd learned to write about history. So at this point, I wanted to write this book differently. I thought that it had trade potential in that I thought that I could pitch this idea to an agent and an editor and get a contract with a publishing house that did a lot of trade book history to sell to more general readers. And so I knew that The Three-Cornered War would be a narrative history. So, and what that generally means is more driven by plot and action and characterization rather than argument. I mean, the arguments are still there, but they're not driving the book forward. And when I started thinking about what that would entail, I mean, I knew that I could write a pretty straight up narrative history, that I could just go from 61 to 68, write a series of chapters involving all of these people who I wanted to write about. But I wanted to kind of challenge myself as a writer. I had also, by this point, left academia. I had decided that I wanted to write full time. So I had no real investment in writing in a traditional academic way. And as I was thinking about how to organize the book and what the best way might be to really bring readers in and to put them on the ground in the Southwest with all of these major players in the conflict, I had actually been reading and watching the Game of Thrones series and had been sort of amazed at why I, when I turned to the novels, I was kind of amazed at why I was continuing to read them, because normally I'm not drawn to really violent and misogynistic fiction. And so I was like, why am I still turning these pages? This is insane. And that's when I kind of looked at the structure of the novels and what George R.R. Martin is doing, which is so genius. And a lot of other fiction writers actually use this, I mean, have been increasingly using this narrative strategy, is to give you multi-perspective narration so that you are moving from one person. You'll have a chapter on one person, then you'll move to the next. You'll come back to major characters later. And what this means is it really creates a sense of anticipation in the reader, while also simultaneously giving the reader this really in-depth look at one person and what that person's doing, what their community is doing. It allows you to really do some pretty deep description on landscape and movement and what people's lives are actually like. Because I think that's what's missing in a lot of history, especially if it's really argument driven, is that, you know, sometimes these big ideas and these movements and actions kind of happen and we don't really find out a lot about the lives of the people, you know, who are actually doing these things and experiencing these things. You know, what did they eat? What did they like? You know, what, how did they experience really cold winters? You know, they're the people in the past, obviously, but they lived as we live, you know? So we find these kinds of things interesting, if people's Instagram feeds are any indication, what they like to eat and where they like to go. And the things that kind of motivate them, we're really interested in. And so, so what I decided to do was to take my nine people and structure the book, much like Game of Thrones, through multi-perspective narration. So if you look at the table of contents, which I think you can do online, you will see that each chapter is named for a person in the book, except for there are three chapters that are not, and those are battles in which multiple people in the books come together. So in those chapters, you'll see these conflicts on the ground, again, from multiple points of view. And what was also driving kind of my choice of these people, I wanted to be able to talk about every single kind of campaign and every movement happening in the Civil War West, which is why, you know, there are nine people. But I also needed, and I think this is very common for all historians, that we need enough sources, right, to give us all that good material to help us build that story. So it was important for me to find people not only who I felt could really, you know, take the reader along and show them what was happening during this period in the 1860s Southwest, but also people who had either produced a lot of letters or diary entries or reports in their own voice, or about whom other people had written a lot. Because it will probably not surprise you to know, Annabelle, or your listeners to know, that the most difficult kind of people's lives to access were the women. Juanita and Louisa Canby did not have any kind of first person traditional sources from them. I only had one letter that I found from Louisa Canby in her own handwriting, and that was from much later in the war, from 1864 in Louisiana. So they had not kept, you know, kind of the traditional records that I would use as a Civil War historian to kind of figure out their lives. But they were prominent people in their communities, and people wrote about them. And in terms of Juanita, who is Navajo, her descendants had, you know, recorded her life experiences and had told stories about her. So the oral histories about her were there and very useful and informative. And Juanita also left some material culture behind. So she was a weaver, and she left at least one textile that we know about. So there were records. They also, it was helpful that Juanita, both Juanita and Louisa Canby, were married to very high profile military leaders in their communities, Manuelito and Richard Canby, respectively. And they produced a lot of records. And so because Louisa and Juanita went with their husbands most of the time during this period, I could track their movements. So that was very helpful. So that's the way that you build stories out of all different kinds of sources that you can. You have to get creative when there are these kinds of archival silences, but it can be done. And you can actually create a fully rich and pretty detailed account of someone's life, even if they don't leave a first person record behind. But the rest of these of the nine, there was a lot of documentation of their words and their actions. And, you know, there are always some holes. You know, there's a period of time for Alonzo Ickes, who was a Union soldier and a gold miner who had been in Colorado for a couple of years. There's a period of time in his diary that's just a total blank, a couple of months during his service in Santa Fe. And there's just one entry that notes that he was shot in the leg, you know, with no other information about how that came to be. So, you know, just like we all do in our work, you deal with those silences however you can and try to fill in those blank spaces. But it was really, it was fun and challenging to do this kind of research, which basically was the research and writing of nine kind of mini biographies and interweaving them together while still making arguments about the significance of the West during the Civil War.
Part one introduces us to this cast of characters that you've managed to pull out of the archive and material trail that is left, while also setting the stage for the expansion of the American Civil War beyond state borders. What does this fissure look like from Diné Bikea and Apacheria?
So in part one, the reader meets Mangus Coloradus, who is a 70-year-old war leader of the Chiricahua Apache people, whose homeland, Apacheria, extended from the Dragoon Mountains a little bit east of Tucson to the Rio Grande, and then further south also into Mexico. And readers also meet Juanita, who I've already talked about a little bit, who is a young woman living in Diné Bikea, a huge area of land belonging to the Navajos that extended from just west of Santa Fe and Albuquerque to the San Francisco Mountains in what Anglos called northwestern New Mexico territory. It was really interesting to see, you know, because one part of the narrative is tracking these Confederate and Union Army movements during the summer and fall of 1861 into the winter of 61-62. And so to try and figure out what Apaches and Navajos really kind of both did in response to this and how they understood it. And I think what happened was that they first understood this conflict between the Union and the Confederacy as a victory of their own, because American soldiers began to evacuate all of the forts that the U.S. government had built in their homelands in the 1850s. Louisa Canby's husband, Colonel E.R.S. Canby, who she called Richard, was ordering all of these soldiers from these forts in central New Mexico territory, which at that time actually extended from the Rio Grande to the California border. Arizona, as we know it today, did not exist yet until 1863. And so he was recalling all of these soldiers from forts from the Rio Grande all the way to Tucson, withdrawing them to the Rio Grande to meet this Confederate invasion threat. And so what Apaches and Navajos are seeing is after, you know, they were in the midst of a decades-long struggle against Americans and the U.S. Army in their homelands. And so they saw these forts emptying out, and they made a very reasonable assumption, which is that their raiding and attacks on these installations in recent years had been successful, and that Americans were withdrawing from their homelands. And this was potentially the beginning of kind of a new era for them to assert their power and their sovereignty in this region. Then when they began to see these really rather large Union and Confederate armies moving along the roads through their homelands in some cases or just adjacent, then they saw the Civil War as an opportunity for a couple of things. One, for raiding. So when U.S. soldiers were evacuated, all the civilians who were living kind of nearby these forts across the Southwest believed that they had no defense then against any Apache or Navajo raids on their sheep herds or their horses or their ranches. And so many of them kind of packed up and started moving. Some moved west toward California. Others moved east toward the Rio Grande. And when they hit the road like that, they actually made themselves quite vulnerable. Because in a desert landscape, like there is in the Southwest, there are lots of open, really open spaces with no real protection. And when you put yourself in a single line in an open landscape like that, you are really, really vulnerable to attacks by anyone who should wish to attack you. So there, both Apache and Navajo raiders had opportunities to do as they had done for many years, which was to make quick strikes on enemies' positions to siphon off a lot of animals that they would later use to shore up their trade relationships in the region. And they did this in relation to civilian wagon trains, and then they also began to raid Union and Confederate wagon trains and army camps and corrals. And these were the real boon, because it's kind of hard to imagine, especially when we think about the Civil War in the East and the many tens of thousands of soldiers that are on the move during that conflict. In the West, the armies are much smaller. They're about 2,000 to 3,000 men on the move on either side or on both sides. In the early 1860s. But in the context of the Southwest, this is a huge number of people. When the Confederates come from Texas, they march almost 700 miles from San Antonio, Texas, to El Paso, and then north to Fort Thorne in New Mexico Territory. And they have 3,000 men, which means around 3,000 horses, and a cattle herd of more than 3,000 animals. And again, all of them are kind of strung out along the road in order to manage water resources. And they were just getting, the soldiers record this in their diaries, they're getting attacked very regularly. The Confederates, mostly by Apaches and sometimes Comanches on the road, and then Union soldiers by Navajos and some Mescalero Apaches. So the Civil War creates these conditions for Native peoples in the region to really accelerate a practice that they had already been engaging in, again, for years, and was the kind of central point in their economic relationships with other Native peoples and with Hispanos in the Southwest. It was also an opportunity for revenge. Apaches in particular had declared war against Americans in February 1861 in the wake of a dispute and a conflict at Apache Pass in what is now Arizona in that February when U.S. soldiers had come after Cochise and the Apaches who were there and accused them of kidnapping a young boy who had been living on a ranch closer to Tucson. And, you know, Cochise had done nothing of the sort, but he had promised to investigate. But the U.S. soldiers had taken some members of his family hostage and tried to take him hostage. And what followed was a pretty bloody but short battle. The U.S. ended up hanging several Apaches from the trees at Apache Pass. And this incident, which was remembered in Chiricahua culture as Cut the Tent, really provoked Chiricahuas into an all-out war against Americans. And so they were seeking revenge for that kind of what they saw both as a betrayal and also an incursion into their territory, an attack on their people. And so this was an opportunity to take revenge on Americans, either civilians or military personnel who were trying to travel through their territory. And it was also an opportunity, I think, for them to exert their power and in some ways to both reassert power and retake parts of their territory that they had lost to American incursions and fort building during the 1850s. So when they saw all of these soldiers leave, many groups moved in. They either looted and destroyed the forts if the soldiers had not done that already, or kind of occupied and used them in other ways. And, you know, these forts were symbols of American military conquest. So for Native peoples to sort of take back these forts and to reintegrate them into their territories was an important step. So the Civil War is creating all of these conditions in the Southwest and really provoking a lot of different kinds of reactions and different scales among the indigenous peoples who live there.
Obviously, Juanita, Mangus Colorados, and other indigenous peoples have a very different view of the conflict than characters like John Baylor, James Carleton, and John Clark. Their respective commitments to the Union and the Confederacy obviously set these actors apart. Yet when the reality of American imperial ambitions are added to the mix, the lines between Northern and Southern begin to blur. How do these imperial aspirations and objectives shape military initiatives on either side?
Yeah, so this is one of the interesting things. I mean, white Northerners and Southerners shared many of experiences and attitudes toward warfare during the Civil War in general. This is one of the things I found out while researching my previous book on destruction, is that white Northerners and Southerners saw destruction in very similar ways. They also shared this idea that the control of the West would provide a couple of really important things. First, gold. So, you know, that was always important. Money was important. It takes money to fight wars. Trade in terms of control of Pacific ports. And this was especially important for the Confederates because they really needed to be able to ship their cotton out of some kind of port, and their ports in the Gulf and the Atlantic were being shut down by a U.S. naval blockade already very early in the war. So they wanted to control those Pacific ports. And also for both Northerners and Southerners, they really saw the West as a central feature of their vision of the future. So for the Confederates, they really wanted to have this continental empire of slavery, where slavery would expand all the way to the Pacific, and then possibly once they defeated the Union, could expand southward into Mexico and Latin America. For the Union, the West became the center of an empire of free labor. So after they defeated the South, then the Union would kind of reestablish its continental empire and build it on the distribution of land and free farming. For both of them, these visions were without indigenous peoples, right? They were just completely erased from this vision of the future. And so their actions in the West really rested on eradicating or removing Native peoples from their homelands across the West. And you can really see this if you look at John Baylor, who is the first person readers will meet in the book, and then James Carleton, who comes onto the scene a little bit later. Because John Baylor, who was a Confederate in command of Mesilla in southern New Mexico territory, the first chapter details how he led a kind of small group of mounted Confederate soldiers into New Mexico, sort of without orders, invaded New Mexico territory, took the town of Mesilla, forced the surrender of a Union regiment at Fort Fillmore, and established, and this was all in the matter of just a couple of days, created and established the Confederate territory of Arizona. And he saw Indian campaigns as part of his purpose in the territory. He had been, you know, it was kind of loosely called a Texas Ranger during his time in Texas, and had really become an enemy of Comanches in particular. He had edited a newspaper called The White Man, and he had ridden around the country kind of whipping up kind of local furor against Comanches. And so he saw himself as an Indian fighter, and he saw part of the purpose of the Confederates was to not only take the Southwest and then the Greater West for the Confederacy, but to also exterminate or remove Native peoples. So he did a lot of things in support of that goal. He sent Sherrod Hunter and Company A of the Arizona Rangers westward along the Butterfield route, which went right through the center of Apacheria, sent him to go take Tucson and told him to just fight and defeat Chiricahuas wherever he found them. He lent support to the Arizona Guards, who were a militia guarding the mines at Pinos Altos, which was a mining town right in the center of Mangus Coloradus's territory. He himself got really bored while waiting for the Confederate Army to kind of dispatch with Union soldiers farther north in New Mexico in February of 1862. And so he just decided, he rounded up a bunch of Anglo guys and some Hispanos and led just this totally off the books invasion of Mexico, claiming that he was in hot pursuit of Apaches who had attacked a wagon train in Confederate Arizona. And he nearly provoked an international incident by doing this. He killed two completely innocent Apaches in the town of Corlitos and, you know, just kind of crossed this boundary and took this action on, you know, kind of claiming that it was on behalf of the Confederacy when he had no command to do that and no authority to do that either. And then in right before he left the territory in March of 1862, he issued this infamous Apache extermination order, instructing the Arizona Guards to lure Chiricahuas into a parlay and ply them with whiskey and then kill all of the men and enslave the women and children. So Confederates, sort of exemplified by Baylor, did have this idea that their war in the Southwest was in part with the Union and in part with Native people. So for them, it was this three-cornered war. James Carleton gets a little more attention, I think, on the Union side because he is the Union commander who creates and leads commands the campaigns against the Union campaigns against Chiricahua Apaches and Navajos beginning in 1863 and extending all the way through the rest of the war. And he was put in command of the Department of New Mexico when he arrived at the Rio Grande in September of 1862. He initially had thought that he might negotiate peace with the Chiricahuas in particular, but his soldiers ran into them at Apache Pass in July of 1862 and fought a battle there. And he decided at that moment that he was going to treat them as enemies and that he would abandon all treaty making. So he was refusing to recognize Native sovereignty. and that he would make war upon them first, force them to surrender, and then remove them to reservations as prisoners of war, and that he would use whatever tactics were at his disposal, particularly hard war tactics, in order to, again, either eradicate or remove Apaches and Navajos so that the Union could take full control of the West. You know, they had, by the spring and summer of 1862, they had already pushed the Confederates back to Texas, but then it became pretty much Carleton's single-minded goal to secure the Southwest in particular and the larger West for the Union by engaging in campaigns against Native peoples. And so really what we see is that for both of these men, for Baylor and Carleton, and for the Confederate and Union interests they represented, that the defeat and removal of Apaches and Navajos from their homelands was absolutely pivotal to not only kind of the Civil War military campaign writ large, but also to the future visions of their respective nations. So that both the North and the South saw Native sovereignty in the West as a challenge and an attempt to subvert American imperial power.
Part two details the eruption of more conflict in New Mexico, and as you just explained, all of these multi-pronged attempts on behalf of the Confederacy and the Union to expand westward and push the Apache and the Navajo out of the way. How do indigenous groups respond, adapt, and act in these circumstances?
So I think the important thing to remember is that indigenous groups across the region responded in a lot of different ways. I mean, as we know, there was not one unified kind of Indian America at any point in our history or during the Civil War itself. So this meant that indigenous groups engaged in the Civil War in different ways, on different scales, kind of across the continent, even in the East as well as the West, and in kind of the Trans-Mississippi Indian Territory in particular. You know, some groups had little or no contact with Union and Confederate troops, and their experience of the Civil War was really minimal. Others, like the Dakota in Minnesota and the Navajos in New Mexico and Arizona, engaged in full scale war. Others kind of had a mix of responses. When Carleton first came through Apache Rhea, he was coming from California. His campaign was meant to meet the Confederate soldiers along the Rio Grande and help Canby and the Union soldiers already there to fully defeat them and push them back into Texas. Carleton had amassed an army of about 2,000 men in Los Angeles by December of 1861, but he was delayed by this massive weather event, the 6-week rainstorm that completely inundated California, and it made them, Southern and Northern California, and it made it incredibly difficult for them to move. And so Carleton's column actually didn't start moving until March and April of 1862, when the Confederates were already kind of on their way out of, you know, retreating back through New Mexico toward Texas. But he was on his way, and his march necessitated crossing Apache Rhea, and he made it to Tucson by July. But because of the nature of the desert, and this is where you see kind of my position as an environmental historian really making this argument that the desert itself really shapes the conflicts in this region among all three groups, the Union, the Confederacy, and Native peoples. Really shapes it in a much stronger way than a lot of other environments do in other theaters of the war. So in order to manage water supplies, Carleton was using a method of staggering, so that he was just sending smaller groups forward every couple of days, so that water supplies along the way would not be depleted. Now this was an extremely good tactic from his point of view, and it actually resulted in very little loss of life from either dehydration or exhaustion along this incredibly long march from Los Angeles to the Rio Grande. But what it meant is that from Tucson, Carleton was sending forwards sort of initially these small groups in the summer of 1862, and they were entering a pacheria in only groups of maybe 100 or 200. And those were numbers that the Chiricahuas really liked and saw in their favor, which is why we have so many kind of confrontations and battles at Apache Pass, which is the site of Apache Spring, which is the only water source between the Dragoon Mountains to the west, and a spring that kind of rises up in the Cook Mountains further to the east. And so anyone moving through that country has to go through Apache Pass in order to get water, in order to survive this march through the desert. So Carleton sending these men through, and Chiricahuas at Apache Pass are responding in a couple of interesting ways. I mean, the first people to come through are a very small group of three riders who are carrying messages for Colonel Canby from Carleton. And, you know, there's only three of them. So the Chiricahuas choose a violent response in that case. And they attack this small group. They kill Chavez and Wheeling, and Jones kind of rides for it and gets away, and is ultimately captured by the Confederates along the Rio Grande. Just a week later, another contingent who are out on a reconnaissance under Edward Ayer, a slightly larger group, come to Apache Pass. And at this point, Cochise, who is there, decides that he'll have a negotiation. And so they have a parley, and in that he learns something very interesting, which is Ayer tells him that Carleton is at Tucson with a huge army. And this is something new. There had not been, there had been a lot of movement coming east to west through a pacheria, gold miners in particular, but also military personnel moving that way. There were mail coaches and some migrants moving the other direction. But this is really the first time that Chiricahuas are seeing a massive army come from this direction through their territory. And so the Chiricahuas do kind of capture a couple of soldiers and do kill them, but Ayer decides not to stick around. And so there's no battle at that point, but it's an interesting sort of approach on Cochise's kind of part to sort of see what the situation is. Cause I think he could tell at this point that this was unusual. And it was also at this point that he sent out riders to other leaders of other Chiricahua bands to come and help him. And so he sends word to Mangus Coloradus. Mangus Coloradus comes with all of his fighting men to Apache Pass. And this is where the battle occurs on July 15th and 16th of 1862. And again, this is a slightly larger group, but not overly large, of California soldiers led by Thomas Roberts. And there's a pitched battle, you know, for 2 days trying to get access and control of Apache Spring. And the battle actually ends up, even though it was pretty evenly matched, the Chiricahuas end up losing control of that spring in the end, and Mangus Coloradus is injured. And from this point on, this kind of shifts Chiricahua strategies in the region, because they no longer have access to this pivotal resource. When Carleton comes through a couple of weeks later, he leaves a very large contingent of soldiers there to build what would become Fort Bowie. So the Union has control of this water source for the rest of the 1860s. Cochise kind of goes off, establishes a stronghold in the Dragoon Mountains and operates kind of around there and in Mexico. Mangus Coloradus is taken to Janos in Mexico, where a surgeon operates on him, and he survives this operation. You know, he's this 70-year-old man, and he's been in many, many fights through his life, and he has survived them all. It's sort of amazing. And he decides to return in the fall of 1862 to his stronghold, which is further east in New Mexico, and decides that with winter coming on that he is going to negotiate. And he sends word to Carleton. Carleton refuses to negotiate with him. And then Mangus Coloradus does something pretty interesting, which is he goes to the town of Pinos Altos, the mining town, and asked to speak with some people there, some miners and other officials, and, you know, talks with them about the possibility of a peace agreement just with the town, which is an interesting kind of approach because, you know, he wants to have, you know, he wants to be able to plant his crops and he wants them, wants to be able to have, you know, sort of peaceful winter with his family and not have to worry about these miners either encroaching on his territory or attacking his camps. So the miners agree because they also would like peace. And so Magus Coloradus goes to try and convince several of his other fellow leaders of Chiricahua bands, including Victorio and Geronimo, to sign on to this peace treaty with him. So here is another strategy. And Magus Coloradus used this strategy a lot during his lifetime. He did not always, you know, war was not always his first act. He often negotiated with people either in official treaties or just agreements. He often had a very kind of rational wait and see approach. Sometimes he talked with Indian agents and received rations. So he was a really skilled leader. He adapted to situations depending on what he thought would kind of work best for his people and how he could do right by his people. And in this case, that kind of attempt to make peace and to kind of settle into some sort of established, nonviolent, maybe a trade relationship, or maybe just the relationship of uneasy neighbors in a pecheria with these Anglos and Americans, you know, this actually backfired on him because in the end, they ended up betraying Magus Coloradus, arresting him and taking him to Fort McLean, which is a little further south, because unbeknownst to Magus Coloradus, James Carleton had officially launched a campaign against him and the rest of the Chiricahua Apaches. So there were hundreds of California column soldiers kind of on their way to southern Apacheria at this moment that he's trying to galvanize Chiricahuas for a peace treaty. The Americans are very much intent on making war upon him.
And we see that come to fruition in part three, which recounts a particularly cataclysmic moment in the Civil War in the West, and that is the death of Magus Coloradus in 1863 at the hands of Union officers. How does this transform the Union's war against Apacheria and Apacheria's war against the Union?
Yeah, so when Magus Coloradus comes in to have a meeting with the miners at Pinos Altos in January of 1863, you know, he thinks he's coming there to negotiate a peace treaty, and he approaches the camp, and a bunch of soldiers kind of rise up around the out of the brush and point their guns at him and take him prisoner. And he, you know, warns off his people and tells them to get out of there, to basically go back to their homelands. Victorio, who was Warm Springs Apache, was with him. Geronimo had said that he would be with him, but he would wait it out at Stein's Peak, which was further west. So Geronimo was not present. But they only took Magus Coloradus prisoner, took him to Fort McLean, where he met Joseph Rodman West, who Carleton had sent to lead this campaign against the Chiricahuas. And, you know, West couldn't even believe it. I mean, the campaign hadn't even really started yet, and already they had been able to capture Magus Coloradus. I think West was pretty astonished by this. And I think he thought that what that meant was that the campaign was over, that the Chiricahuas, you know, with the capture of their most prominent war leader, would kind of give up. But they really underestimated and completely misunderstood the nature of Chiricahua society. And, you know, this was part of their problem as well. But Magus Coloradus was taken prisoner and put in a kind of ruined building. Fort McLean had been destroyed when American soldiers had left it in 1861. And soldiers began to torture him that night. They were throwing rocks at him. They were kind of heating up their bayonets and pricking his feet. And when he kind of rose up to object and, you know, say, I'm not a child to be trifled with, the soldiers shot him and killed him. And so that was the kind of first action, was the murder of Mangus Coloradus. The official story was among, you know, Union officers, Joseph Rodman West wrote to Carleton that Mangus Coloradus was shot while trying to escape. That was not true. And what really pushed Chiricahuas over the edge when they heard about this was that soldiers had taken Mangus Coloradus's body out and buried it in a gully. But a couple of days later, a regimental surgeon had gone out and dug him up and then brought him back to the tent and cut off his head and boiled it in a big black kettle in order to have the skull, which he later sent. He carried it around with him actually for several years in the Southwest. And then he sent it eastward to a phrenologist to study it and to kind of try and, you know, the phrenology was the study of kind of all the shapes of the head to try and figure out your character as a person. So the surgeon did this. And when Chiricahuas found out about this, they were enraged because in their culture, you move through eternity with the body you have when you die. And so for them, this was kind of a double betrayal. Like not only had Mangus Coloradus been betrayed by these miners at Pinos Altos and the U.S. Army, but then they had done this terrible thing to his body that meant that his afterlife would be unsettled. And so while Joseph Rodman West thought, oh, this is going to be the end of the campaign, actually it was the beginning of the campaign for the Chiricahuas. And Cochise and Victorio and Geronimo, basically for the next 20 years, you know, defended their territories against American incursions, launched raids and attacks on various towns in southern New Mexico and Arizona, and also in northern Mexico. They every now and again they would be captured or have a treaty negotiation, but they always resisted being removed to reservations, especially reservations that were far from their homelands. And the end of the conflict didn't come for the U.S. Army and the Chiricahuas until the mid-1880s. And it all stems from this point, this sort of Civil War action and the murder of Mangus Coloradus.
Much like the conclusion of the American Revolutionary War several decades earlier, the Civil War's impact among indigenous nations, as you just mentioned, continued to linger well after 1865. Manuelito, Juanita, and the Diné are forced to make difficult choices here. How and why did the Diné adapt to further American encroachment after the Union's victory?
So this is the Union's campaign against the Diné, the Navajos, was much more successful in their view than their campaign against the Chiricahuas in the South. Carleton had sent Kit Carson, who is another one of the nine people who readers will meet in the book. He sends Kit Carson out in the fall of 1863 to launch a hard war against the Navajos. And I, you know, I think the goal was to bring them to battle. But Navajos, you know, like Chiricahua Apaches as well, you know, they never entered a battle. They knew they couldn't win. They always would launch attacks and go into battle if they had a strength in numbers and a strong position in terms of environment. They were in control of a water resource, or they were had the high ground in some way. And so, you know, Kit Carson was riding through Diné Vaquea with a group of about 500 or 600 soldiers, and that's a lot of fighting men. And so most Navajo bands responded to this not by meeting them in battle, but by scattering and taking their people with them in order to establish a place of safety. And sometimes they would raid corrals or other camps during this period. But most of the time, their strategy was one of evasion. And It wasn't until January of 1864, when Kit Carson launched a winter campaign in Canyon de Chelly, that large numbers of Navajos decided that in order to survive, they were going to have to surrender. Because Kit Carson's campaigns had been successful. In fact, they hadn't been able to bring Navajos to the battlefield, but they had been able to destroy a lot of their croplands, which destroyed all of the crops that would feed Navajos through the winter. And they had destroyed a lot of hogans, their winter houses, their permanent housing, and other kind of home sites and other, 3,000 peach trees, which were not destroyed during this campaign, but a little bit later. But the peach trees in Canyon de Chelly, which had been, a great source of diet diversity for Navajos, especially in the winter and the springtime. So, by the time Carson went to Canyon de Chelly in January of 1864, many Navajos were starving. Many were already vulnerable. The hard war campaign had had its psychological effect in proving that the U.S. Army was going to come and keep on coming. So over the course of a couple of months, from January to about April or May, 1864, somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 Navajos surrendered, to the U.S. Army and were forcibly removed, to Bosque Redondo, which was a reservation that James Carleton had picked out along the Pecos River in central New Mexico. And that was a 400-mile march. So, this is another one of those experiences that people have in this region, although this one was obviously a forced removal and not a voluntary march, but they were moving through this very vast desert landscape with not a lot of material resources at hand. And there was a lot of suffering on that march and a very large death toll. So from this point on, there are still Navajos who remain in Dina Bekea. Juanita and Manuelito are two of them, and their band, who remain, as James Carleton calls them, fugitive Navajos until 1866. And it's important to remember that not all Navajos did go to Bosque Redondo. We don't have hard numbers, but some historians think somewhere between 15% to 20% did not go. They managed to stay out. They managed to evade the U.S. Army through this entire period. So the people who did go to Bosque Redondo, however, were able to survive and to persist. Again, there was a very high mortality rate, but there was a large community there. They did what they could in order to survive. They were being forced to live in ways that were completely contrary to their own way of life. At Bosque Redondo, they were forced to farm huge tracts of land in monocrop agriculture, which is not something they did traditionally. They were forced to live in dirt huts in close proximity to one another, which again is not the way they chose to arrange their kind of built environment in Dina Bekea. They had to adjust to eating rations, which were kind of flour-based, which is not something that they were used to eating, but they adapted to that. And they were forced to send their children to school to learn English. And also there were some missionaries there who were trying to Christianize them. But they resisted in a variety of ways. They counterfeited ration tickets. They manipulated the labor system to procure more food from the Union Army. They hunted off reservation without passes. And they also initiated a series of large-scale breakouts where usually leaders of bands like Manuelito would gather up their people and then just leave the reservation in the middle of the night in a group of maybe 200 or 300. And the Union Army was able to hunt down most of these groups, but not all of them. Some of them succeeded in getting away. They also, whenever Bosque Redondo became controversial quite early on, mostly because it was incredibly expensive. And so the U.S. Congress was really interested to know why it was costing so much to incarcerate what became you know, around between 8,000 and 10,000 Navajos in this place. And so there were a lot of congressional representatives who came in over the course of a couple of years in the 1860s to kind of check out the situation. And at every point, Navajos were asked about their experiences. And at every point, they're completely consistent. They told the truth about everything, about the high rates of disease, about the mortality rates, about the overwork, about women who were raped, and, you know, babies who had died of exposure and starvation, the lack of wood to build houses and fires. And ultimately, this meant that they were able, in a final kind of visit from congressional representatives, William Tecumseh Sherman, crazily, was one of those representatives who came in May of 1868 to negotiate a treaty with the Navajo. And the U.S. government wanted to send the Navajos to Indian territory. They wanted to put them on land that they had actually confiscated from Confederate Native peoples who had fought for the Confederacy and were forced to give up their land. And they wanted to put the Navajos there. And the Navajos said, no, we're not going. If we're going to leave Bosque Redondo at all, we're going to go back to their homeland. And they were able, through the force of argument and through the, you know, the force of their convictions and their willingness, you know, to tell the truth about this place, they were able to negotiate their return to their homeland in June of 1868. And in July, they were able to return to Diné Bikéya, which had not been settled by Anglos during the time that they, during the 4 or 5 years that they had been incarcerated at Bosque Redondo. And when they got back, you know, they had to give up a lot. They signed a treaty in which they gave up a lot of their rights. It was a kind of bittersweet victory for them. But the treaty did recognize their sovereignty. And over the course of the decades after their return, Navajos were actually able to add lands to their reservation site that had been, you know, where the boundaries had been placed by the treaty in 1868. And today, they are the largest reservation in the nation because of that. They have grown and expanded their power in the region. They're one of the only indigenous groups to have been able to do that. So the story for them, I think, of their experience of the Civil War in the West and of Bosque Redondo is an incredibly important moment for them in their history. It's one of great suffering, but it is also one of survival and persistence.
You conclude with a powerful yet oft-overlooked reality of the Civil War's continental scope, that, quote, these struggles for power in the West exposed a hard and complicated truth about the Union government's war aims, that they simultaneously embraced slave emancipation and Native extermination in order to secure an American empire of liberty, end quote. When the histories in your book are placed in conversation with other simultaneous processes of expansion and elimination, like the U.S.-Dakota War, we really see Union imperialism in its exterminationist, expansionist entirety. How does this change the way that historians should be looking at, understanding, and explaining the Civil War?
So this is, I think, really the most important point, not only of the Three-Cornered War, but of a lot of the work that's been coming out on the Civil War West recently, that kind of shifting our viewpoint from the Eastern Theater to the far West, in Civil War history really reveals that the Civil War was a continental conflict. You know, it was about the North and the South, but it was also about the West. And that it was a continuation of the imperialist aims and actions of the United States, not a pause in that process. You know, Ari Kalman was the first one to really argue that the Civil War was an Indian war in this region, in Misplaced Massacre. And several scholars since then have begun to kind of take up this argument and really kind of make the case that this, if we ignore the West, we sort of ignore this whole component of the war that was important in shaping not only its military campaigns, but also political action. Because the Union Army is able to, you know, shove the Confederates back to Texas, the Union Congress is able to pass the Homestead Act and the Pacific Railway Act, and also create the Department of Agriculture. And those actions they took in, or in, you know, kind of the pursuit of this larger vision of an entire continent settled by white farmers, and, you know, totally, totally sort of absent of Native peoples. And that in conjunction with the military campaigns, these political acts were going to get this done. So that's one thing that the view from the West does. It also shows us hard war at work in another context, not just in, you know, South Carolina or in, you know, the Missouri Guerrilla War, but in official Union campaigns targeting Native peoples. Interestingly, and I haven't talked about this very much really, but it also shows us multiracial armies that were in place for the Union long before the Emancipation Proclamation. The Union Army that fights the Confederates at Valverde and Apache Canyon Glorieta are armies that include both Hispano volunteers and militia, and also Anglo volunteers and army regulars, and in some cases, Native scouts and spies, auxiliaries. And Kit Carson uses Utes in his campaign against Navajos, which is fought predominantly also by the First New Mexico, which is mostly Hispano soldiers from New Mexico. So that's an interesting component that we haven't talked about, and it really kind of changes our view, I think, of in the Civil War writ large of what constitutes armies and also what constitutes citizen soldiers. And one of the other things, and I haven't talked about this very much either, but in the book, I do go into it a bit, which is that in the far West, the issue of slavery is quite complicated, because here there was a very long history of indigenous and Hispano enslavement, fueled by warfare and raiding and trading, a huge kind of Southwestern trade network in enslaved peoples. And there was a range of unfree labor practices, including peonage. And this is one of the reasons, actually, that Henry Sibley and the Confederates thought that once they got into New Mexico, that Hispano New Mexicans would be amenable to an alliance with the Southerners, because they were slave owners. That turned out to be a wrong assumption, mostly because Hispano New Mexicans hated Texans more than they loved slavery. But they had passed a pro-slavery law in 1859. They later got rid of it. They repealed it. But many Hispanos kept their Navajo and Apache slaves until 1867, when the federal government felt they had to actually pass this act called the Peonage Act in order to enforce the 13th Amendment in New Mexico territory. So here again is a much longer sort of time frame if we're thinking about the history of emancipation during the Civil War. If you bring the West into it, it brings in a kind of different viewpoint that really complicates the trajectory that we're used to talking about. So I think when we see the war from this region that not many people know about, that, you know, is often ignored in military histories. Actually, most Civil War histories, if you look at a book and it's either a general synthesis or history of the war or a textbook, the map of the war actually ends in Texas. It sort of cuts down sort of pretty neatly almost along the 100th meridian. Like the half of the country doesn't even exist during the war. So of course, nobody thinks that anything happened in this part of the continent because they're not actively seeing it. But when we redraw that map, when we put the Pacific Coast and the Northwest and the Southwest kind of, and the, you know, Rocky Mountain Plains back into this picture, I think it creates a much fuller and more complete and more complex image of the Civil War and its aims.
Well, Megan, we've taken up a lot of your time. Before we wrap up, I have one last question for you. What are you working on now?
So I have just started writing the next project, which is called This Strange Country, Yellowstone and the Reconstruction of America. So it is in some ways kind of a sequel to The Three-Cornered War, in that it is the story of the 1871 scientific survey to Yellowstone, which culminated in the 1872 Yellowstone Act, which created the first national park in the world. And the people who are involved in this story are politicians, they are scientists, they are businessmen and editors, and there are also several Native leaders who are resisting this kind of survey and these kinds of these acts that we would consider, you know, sort of conservation or kind of environmentally focused acts, resisting them as yet another incursion into their own territory and an attack on their own sovereignty. So I'm investigating in this book, again, a lot of these complex interactions between different communities in the West, sometimes violent, sometimes not, but all trying to exert power and control over a place and use it to define not only their own kind of boundaries of power, but define who they are as a people.
Megan, that sounds like another important project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thanks, Annabelle.